Think is made possible by Guaranty Bank, Perot Systems, Southwest Securities, and the Executive Education Center at the University of Dallas.
Welcome to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Who's to blame for Americans' disgraceful actions at Abu Ghraib? The soldiers who posed for digital snapshots while abusing detainees, or the system that ignored the violence as it was taking place? In his new documentary, Standard Operating Procedure, filmmaker Errol Morris explores the facts behind those infamous images and talks to some of those who have been held accountable.
When I was in the brig, every single woman there was in that brig because of a man. Different reasons, yes, but it was because of a man. And when you join the military, no matter what anybody says, it's a man's world. You have to either equal a man or be controlled by a man. If you want to be their equal, you got to be strong. They're going to try to control you. You need to step up and tell them, you know, show them who's boss. I'm not going to take that. I'm not going to let you power me, you know, control me because I'm a woman and you're a man. It's not going to happen. Even though it's the military, I mean, hell, if you're in the military, you got a gun. Use it. If I would have thought about that then, by God, I would have. But I was blinded by being in love with a man. Grainer, he's really charming. If you didn't know him and you just meet him, you'd be drawn into him. In a crowded room, he'd be the one to look at. He would draw the tension. If the tension is not on him, he'll get it there. That's what he does. He thrives on that.
That was disgraced soldier Lindy England, interviewed for documentarian Errol Morris's new film, Standard Operating Procedure. And Errol Morris is here now to talk about the project. Errol, welcome to Think.
Thank you for thinking about me for Think.
You know, it's interesting. You see Lindy England talking about being in trouble because of a man. One of the things that added to the shock for many Americans
Fortunately, I'm not that man.
You are not the guy, exactly. One of the things that added to the shock was the fact that women were so directly involved in the images that we saw. And in fact, their presence there at the prison was meant to be intimidating for the prisoners. Is that right?
It is. Part of policy. Sexual humiliation. You would think it only is prevalent in high school, but it is very much part of our interrogation policies in Iraq. That's the very surprising part.
Who was kept at Abu Ghraib? What sorts of prisoners were there?
All kinds. The photographs mislead us in lots of different ways. I know that when I first saw the photographs, I thought that Abu Ghraib was just one prison corridor, a couple of MPs. Abu Ghraib was the intelligence hub of the war effort in Iraq. But by the end of 2003, you have 10,000 prisoners. This was a city, not a corridor. So most of what went on there, we don't even know about. It's been hidden. It was never photographed. We know nothing.
Let's talk about the phrase standard operating procedure, also the title of the film. One of the things that you go into is the fact that part of the investigation dealt with the military having to sift through what was really bad behavior that needed to be punished and what was allowed. And it was a much more difficult process than we might imagine.
It still confuses me. One of the more dramatic moments in standard operating procedure is this moment where the prosecution expert points at the most infamous photograph from Abu Ghraib, the photograph of the hooded man on the box with wires, and says, that's standard operating procedure. I've spent, what, 2+ years with this material. It seems to me, and this is the frightening theme in the movie, that everything was standard operating procedure. Once all of these rules are relaxed, once sexual humiliation and intimidation is made part of policy, everything falls apart.
We have a clip now that shows exactly that image that you're talking about and gives a little explanation. So let's take a look at that.
Gilligan was the one on the box with the wires. He was accused of killing 2 CID agents. It was his box. He had to hold it. He had to stand on it. It was cold, so he had a blanket on. I mean, he was never physically ever touched that I saw. He was just very, very tired. He kept giving us different names. So Grainer nicknamed him Gilligan. When I got there, he was in the shower. There was wires on his fingers. And he was told he would be electrocuted if he fell off. There was no electricity going through the wires. And to say, hey, if you fall off, you're going to be electrocuted. I mean, that would keep anybody awake. So it was part of the sleep plan.
That was Sabrina Harmon, who appeared in some of the images and was behind the camera for many more. Errol, why would anyone involved in this kind of behavior have taken photographs of it?
Believe it or not, Sabrina Harmon, who was narrating that piece of film that you just saw, she's the daughter and the brother of police officers. She herself wanted to work for the police. She wanted to be a forensic photographer. And many of the pictures she took as evidence of crimes being committed by the military. Such a bizarre story. You take pictures hoping to provide evidence, and somehow it's turned against you. It's used to put you in prison. This is an untold story about Abu Ghraib. We know so little about these people. Photographs that have been seen by literally hundreds of millions of people, but no one ever thought to talk to the people who took the photographs, just to ask them very simple questions. Hey, why did you take those photographs? What do you think you were doing? What was going on in these images that I'm looking at? All of these kinds of questions were never asked, but they were asked by me in this movie.
One of the things that is so difficult about watching the film, for me, is that you go back and forth between really being disgusted by the things that these people were doing or witnessing without crying out about what was happening. And then you really do feel sorry for them. You feel empathy for them, at least. They were in this horrible situation. It sounds like they were not given really any training in terms of how to handle a military prison of this nature. Was it something that you struggled with, making sure that the balance was correct between empathizing with these people and still holding them accountable for whatever part they had in these crimes?
There's a simple answer to that question, yes. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of trouble interviewing people if I don't like them on some level. And yes, I empathize with all of these people, some more than others. It's a very sad and very complex story. Part of the story of the war in Iraq, of course, is a story of an untrained, under-equipped, understaffed army going to war. Relaxed policies about interrogations, rules of engagement. You look back on it, and it's pretty clear this is a disaster waiting to happen. And, of course, it did happen. No big surprise.
There's a combination of, obviously, shots that were taken at Abu Ghraib and interviews, and then you did some reenactments of the prison. Can you talk about how you fabricated something that would look like Abu Ghraib?
We built part of the prison block on a stage in Los Angeles. If I'm listening to an interview, there will be phrases, lines that will leap out at me. I'll hear something and I'll think, oh, that suggests an image. That's something that I would like to illustrate. It's happened in all of my films, and it certainly happened in Standard Operating Procedure. My attention was directed to something someone said, and then I want my audience to think about it as well, perhaps even thinking about it the way I'm thinking about it.
It's helpful to have the images because so often during the interviews we want to look away. There's so much direct eye contact from the people who are speaking in the film, and it's hard because they represent America in some ways, and it's sort of hard to look these people in the eye and hear them telling their stories in such dispassionate ways.
Well, remember, these people have been demonized. They are considered by most people the ultimate villains. Part of my job is to turn them back into people, to show myself as well as everybody else that these really are people wrestling with ethical and moral questions. People trapped. I think that's the very best way to describe them. Trapped in a nightmare. But they didn't create the nightmare. They walked in on something that was already up and running, already well established, and there was no way out. It's easy for us, I think, easy to say, oh, I would have done such and such, or I could have done this and that. But the reality of it is you're in the military, and you're in the middle of the Sunni triangle. You're in the middle of a war zone, and there's very, 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 very little you can do about it. It's a very disturbing and sad story, but a powerful and interesting story, I hope, because I think it has something to teach us about ourselves.
Did you sense that they were genuinely sorry for what they had done, or outraged that they had been persecuted?
Well, put yourself, say, in Lindy England's place. You're a 20-year-old woman. You haven't really done much of anything except take pictures. Maybe you have a bad boyfriend, whatever. And the entire failure of the war effort gets placed on your shoulders. You get blamed. You take the fall. Would you be entirely remorseful, or would you be angry? Almost all of the people that I talk to, this is true of Brigadier General Karpinski all the way down to Private First Class Lindy England, all these people are angry. And here's the real reason for the anger. They've watched so many people who were even more directly involved skate away without punishment. They see the higher-ups destroying evidence, hiding evidence. They don't get punished. But the lowliest soldiers do. And that's unfair. It's unjust. It's not right.
Well, let me take the same question and pose it from the perspective of the highest levels of the Defense Department. Do you think the Defense Department was truly sorry for what happened to those detainees, or just sorry that they got caught?
I believe they're sorry they got caught. Because the real crime... sorry, I should start again. The real crime here is taking photographs. That's what they got punished for. There's a photograph that I'm obsessed with. A picture of Sabrina Harmon with her thumbs up, big smile on her face, body of an Iraqi prisoner. I remember seeing this photograph for the first time, and I thought, what a monster. What have I learned? I've learned that she didn't kill this man. He was killed by the CIA. And she took the pictures because she wanted to provide evidence of a crime committed by others. Who gets punished? Does the killer get punished? No. Do the people involved in the cover-up get punished? No. She goes to jail for a year. I'd like to see the people who are responsible for these policies and responsible for the abuse to be held accountable for it, just simple as that. Someone made this comparison to me about Nuremberg. They said, well, we know from Nuremberg that just following orders is no excuse. And I pointed out, wait a second, at Nuremberg, we didn't punish privates and corporals and sergeants. We punished the highest officials of the military and the government. And to me, at some point, there has to be a day of reckoning.
Errol, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
The documentary Standard Operating Procedure opens in North Texas later this month. Just ahead on Think, singer-songwriter David Garza talks about his part in the Latino Cultural Center's live staging of an anthology of Texas-Mexican literature. First, take a look at this week's arts calendar.
The Art and Seat calendar for Independence Day weekend features a farce, a kid-friendly musical, and futuristic folk art. Kettle Art in Deep Ellum is the place to see Dallas painter Kathy Miller's Prepared Americans, her colorful series of works inspired by FEMA's Are You Ready? Guide to Citizen Preparedness. The Galleria de la Rosa in Fort Worth's Rosemarine Theater hosts the opening of Man, Myth, and Machine, a collection of paintings from Juan J. Hernandez exploring Aztec mythology, immigration, and machines. For a toe-tapping take on the Romeo and Juliet fable, Dallas Summer Musicals offers up Disney's High School Musical, now playing at the Fair Park Music Hall. And keeping it in the happy vein, Stage West in Fort Worth invites you out for Michael Frayn's uproarious award-winning comedy Noises Off, a cheeky behind-the-scenes and on-stage peek at the production of a British sex farce. For more about these events, join us at artandseek.org, a new website for the arts in North Texas. For Art and Seek, I'm Jeannie Mascoro.
What does it mean to be made in Texas? On May 3rd, the Latino Cultural Center will stage the Hecho en Texas anthology of works by Texans with Mexican roots. This unique event will combine readings by authors with live musical performances. Irving-born singer-songwriter David Garza is among the artists featured in both the book and the show. David, welcome to Think.
Hello, thank you.
So often when we talk about efforts like this, the word heritage comes into play. Mm-hmm. But it's very clear that Hecho en Texas is very much about right now. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Well, right now is a really amazing time because things are being broken down. Even, you know, in the 70s, being of Mexican descent, a Texan, was very different than being Mexican descent from Texas right now. I think what, you know, with the technology and the revolution of the internet over the last 10, 15 years, I think it's really broken down a lot of racial stereotypes and a lot of racial boxes. And I think when I think about this book and I think about right now, it's a perfect marriage of now and heritage, which is a celebration, because it's looking forward to the next wave of whatever's going to happen, which is hopefully right around the corner.
Can you talk about how music connected you to your culture when you were growing up?
Oh, music was my culture when I was growing up. It was, you know, growing up where your blood is one thing, but what comes out of your mouth is a different thing. Is sometimes difficult because you look a certain way, but you talk another way. So, you know, there's a lot of language prejudice still to this day. But, you know, growing up in Texas, born in Irving, you know, it was a different time back then. There was only one. It was KESS. The heritage of my music or the music of my heritage was really speaking to me through that radio station. But then Q102 was there. So music was always a big deal. And when you hear Led Zeppelin, on Q102, it sometimes sounds like, you know, cumbia on KESS. Or when you hear some Norteño band doing a rock and roll, it kind of sounds like K the Eagle 97 or whatever. So I was really, at a young age, realizing that there's no one answer. It's not just like, oh, if you're this way, you play that music, or this way, you play that music, you know. So that was a big deal for me to realize that through music.
Yeah, what's interesting about that insight is that I'm sure there's no one answer even for Texans of Mexican descent. I mean, for some people, it's easy to switch from cumbia to Led Zeppelin, and for some, they feel like very separate things.
Yeah.
Was it something that you, even with your other friends who are Mexican-American, you realized that your experience of moving seamlessly was different than theirs?
Oh, 100%, because I really was, as I started music, you know, it was a lot of traditional music, but I also studied classical piano, so at that age, at a very young age, 7, 8 years old, I realized, hey, there's this third language. It's not just Spanish or English. There's music. And music is really the mother of all languages. So I that's my trip, is music. And that's why I can really stand with objectivity and praise a book or an album or a band that doesn't really have to just sing in English or sing in Spanish or think in English or think in Spanish. And that's exciting to me.
I know that it's not the music you make a living with, but do you have a chance to play Mexican music very often anymore?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, it's sometimes you just reach back and grab something that you heard when you were a kid, and it speaks to somebody in a way that you would never think of. But, you know, like you go to El Paso, and there's more people that are like myself that you want to hear a certain song or a certain type of tune. If you're in Nebraska, it's not necessarily the same thing, but I think it's just the beautiful thing about having an upbringing like myself and people in this amazing book is that we got so much to choose from. It's this big bag, and we just keep grabbing and grabbing because it's just getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah. Was there a point at which, after you became an adult, that you traveled around and realized it was different to be a Texan who has Mexican roots than to be from California Arizona or somewhere else?
Well, it's kind of like food, you know. You go to California, you can't find Tex-Mex food. You come to...
Some would argue that's a good thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, but you can't find, you know, the Baja kind of whatever food in Texas. And the culture is the same way. I mean, there they say Chicano, here we say Tejano. It used to be something that you would kind of get in a knife fight over, but now it's just something you laugh about and like I said, celebrate. So, there's definitely a difference, and there's a lot of regionalism, which is still, is a good thing, I think.
The piece that you have in the book, the poem, is actually a song lyric. Is that one of the things that you'll be performing?
I guess. I don't know. I usually just play what I play.
So you just go up there, and that sounds like a really exciting thing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, sometimes, there's some lyrics in there from other people, like Lydia Mendoza, who's an amazing singer who just recently passed away. She's kind of like what I would call my Robert Johnson or my... My Louis Armstrong as a Tejano. She was a singer-songwriter from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and she actually recorded here in downtown Dallas. And so I sometimes open the book and sing one of her songs or sing a Santiago Jimenez song or whatever. And they're all in the book, so you just kind of, you open your missal to page 25 and just do one of those jams.
So. You grew up in the 70s and 80s. Would you change that time? Would you rather be a kid now because things
no
are
way.
So open?
No way. It's boring to be a kid now.
Really?
Yeah, you can't go anywhere. Your parents are all telling you, stay here, don't go there.
Yeah, the world's gotten much more dangerous. Everybody's wearing a helmet and everything.
Exactly. No, it was cool back then.
David, thank you so much for
being
here.
Thank you so much.
The Echo en Tejas Literary and Musical Performance takes place May 3rd at 7:30. The book that inspired it is out now in stores. For free video and audio podcasts, you can go to kera.org/think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for being with us, and have a great week.
Think is made possible in part by Guaranty Bank, using its more than 100 years of business experience to provide financing for small and medium-sized businesses and independent oil and gas producers throughout Texas. By Perot Systems, a technology services company trusted by more than 500 clients worldwide. Perot Systems delivers technology infrastructure services, consulting, application solutions, and business process solutions that enable growth. By Southwest Securities, a nationally recognized regional brokerage firm that's been meeting the needs of Southwest investors for more than 30 years. Southwest Securities is a member of the New York Stock Exchange and SIPC. And by the Executive Education Center at the University of Texas at Dallas, providing degree and non-degree programs to help corporate professionals and executives stay ahead. On the web at som.utdallas.edu/executive.